Sai Ram, and a warm good morning, dear listeners. This is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, welcoming you to this week's Radio Sai Answering Booth, a show which, like all other programs, we present in Radio Sai tries to explore Bhagwan's infinite yet practical and relevant message. Only we do it through questions and answers in this show. Your questions and my answers. Or to put it more precisely, you are instrumental in posing the questions and I am instrumental in presenting the answers. So let us begin by offering our most humble pranams to the source of all of this, our dearest Swami. So let's head to the program then. Yes, as always, I have an interesting quote to start with. Then we have a question relating to a practical problem we all face. And if time permits, I'm going to present for all of you a beautiful, beautiful poem written by Swami. So there are a lot of interesting things lined up. Fasten your seatbelts and join me in the ride. So let's start with a quote of the day, and today I'm going to read the words of another of my all-time favorites, the Lebanese poet, artist and writer Khalil Gibran. And if you were wondering if it is from his epic work, The Prophet, of course, yes, it is. The lines I wish to read today are the following. I quote, "The deeper that sorrow carves into your being, the more joy you can contain. Is not the cup that holds your wine the very cup that was burned in the potter's oven? And is not the lute that soothes your spirit the very wood that was hollowed with knives? When you are joyous, look deep into your heart, and you shall find it is only that which has given you sorrow that is giving you joy. When you are sorrowful, look again in your heart, and you shall see in truth that you are weeping for that which has been your delight." End of quote. I don't really have to explain that quote, isn't it? Because of the very reason I like the works of Gibran, and that is his simplicity. But what he says in these lines is a very, very essential perspective change that we need to bring in our approach to our lives. In the first two lines, he speaks of how it is sorrow that brings into our life the ability to find joy and also appreciate it. In fact, he says the deeper sorrow carves into our heart, the more joy our heart can contain. Well, that's precisely what Swami would hint at when he would say, "Na sukhat labhyate sukham." Happiness does not be born out of happiness. So we may not necessarily go after sorrow and pain, that's not the idea, but at least we need not fear it and do stupid things in an effort to avoid it, right? There will be a sense of acceptance, and that acceptance will lead to equanimity. In the last line of that quote, he speaks of just the opposite. What does he say? He says, just as how it is sorrow and pain that makes joy sweet, and thereby, in a sense, sorrow is the source of joy, so too, that which gives joy is what gives sorrow too. Well, he says, in truth, that you are weeping for had been your delight some time back. In fact, Swami would say the same thing too. In fact, in one of the Science Bias quotes that we sent out just a while ago, maybe a couple of weeks back, Swami says, remember, there is nothing in the world which can give you unmixed joy. Even if there is one such thing, when that thing is lost, you will become very sad. This is the very nature of this world. And again, what happens when we always remember this truth? It will give us a certain amount of dispassion, right? So when we acknowledge that sorrow is the source of joy, and that which gives joy is also capable of becoming the source of sorrow, we will automatically develop what we call vairagya, one of the most important qualities necessary for spiritual progress. Beautiful quote indeed, isn't it? So listeners, before we head to the question of the week, permit me to read those profound words of Khalil Gibran one more time. I quote, "The deeper that sorrow carves into your being, the more joy you can contain. Is not the cup that holds your wine the very cup that was burned in the potter's oven? And is not the lute that soothes your spirit the very wood that was hollowed with knives? When you are joyous, look deep into your heart and you shall find it is only that which has given you sorrow that is giving you joy. When you are sorrowful, look again in your heart and you shall see in truth that you are weeping for that which has been your delight." It's time to head to the question of today's week. The listener who sent us her question is not new to our show. She's already sent us, I think, two or three questions before this. So it's from Sister Prashanti from the United States. And as always, she has been kind enough to record the question in her own voice. And as I mentioned in the beginning of the program, it is a question which practically all of us face. All of us, in some form or the other, have to deal with this situation. So let's listen to a question and we'll proceed to answer that after we listen to that.
Om Shri Sai Ram Prem. Hearty congratulations to our Radio Sai Answering Booth program, which has taken leaps and bounds during these episodes. It's been a while, but I couldn't send my questions, but always I keep noting them down. And for this week, I wanted to send this question, which seemed to be very apt to a situation which I always encounter frequently. So here is the question. Swami's discourses have all the answers. He has taught us how to deal with anger, how to not react versus respond, and then how to see only good, or I would say Swami or a child in everyone, like see only goodness. And all this is fine, but what practical problem I face with this is, currently when we are speaking with a person, we are supposed to either hear and not react and then keep hearing, and there is a situation we might have to respond while speaking itself. So for our mind to perceive, or I mean mind quickly understands the language and it goes into the judge mode, it kind of builds up the answers while the person is talking. So most of the times I manage to stay quiet and then react the scene in front of me, or re-picture the scene that happened, and then regret, I shouldn't have reacted, I should have said this, I shouldn't have said this, or I should have thought in this angle, this person meant in different way, and it was not worth it to react or defend yourself, or could be in defense to yourself, or in defense to hearing criticism about others, or in situations where you are questioned. Like, I don't like being too intrusive about other people. I sometimes expect the same. Like, why, when you are questioned, why did you do this or why did you not? Many situations like this. The answers come out better when we take time, but sometimes it has to happen instantly, and we go through a certain stress or anxiety, like a sine curve, some emotion piles up, and immediately, though we are not saying anything at the time when the person is speaking, we are going through certain emotions. I would want to hear from you anything from the experiences you heard or came across, or if anything relating to this tips shared by Swami. What we have to imagine in our mind when we are hearing some negative talk or criticism, or we are being judged, or any kind of negative situation, I would say, right at that moment, how should we, what should our mind think, and what should we do at that point of time to avoid certain consequences of reacting, or inside, even if you don't say anything, that builds up stress if you develop some kind of emotion, and then we vent it out, maybe not towards that person, or that comes out as stress symptom in our own life. It impacts our work or impacts the immediate people around us. These situations we often encounter at work, at home, or while we are speaking over the phone, or we are doing anything in general. So I would like to hear what I could do to help me with this kind of situations. Sai Ram.
Thank you, Sister Prashanti, for that question. And as I mentioned, how many of us don't face that situation in life, especially when being judged, when being criticized in the course of a conversation? And of course, that question was very, very wide in the sense it involves a lot of things that we try to develop in the process of improving spiritually. I mean, it involves anger management. It involves enormous amount of self-improvement. It involves conversation skills, which we take too lightly. And of course, maintaining an equanimity during all times, right? And so in general, you know, if we are progressing spiritually, actually, this is a very, very good index of our growth. How are we able to handle people judging us? How are we able to handle criticism? How are we able to handle difficult situations, especially in one-to-one conversations, or you know, in groups when we are talking to each other? But we will try to see, you know, this as a process. Also, we can consciously try and improve ourselves, like what Sister Prashanti was asking. In crux, what she said was right. You know, it's about learning how to respond rather than react. And most of us, most of the time, tend to react to situation, react to what people tell us, and react to provocation, right? Well, you know, we will stick to conversations, especially those which are provocative in nature, because there can be even general conversations where we need the skills which I'm going to talk about, but we'll stick to conversations where we tend to get provoked, where we tend to lose our temper, or even conversations where we tend to start criticizing ourselves, probably go into a shell, feel low about ourselves. The emotions are different, but the process which we go through in the course of these emotions are pretty much same and can be dealt with in a very similar manner. So to start with, you know, there are two things that can happen in any provocative conversation like that. One is, I am misunderstanding what that person is saying and I'm getting hurt. Like what Sister Prashanti, you mentioned, that many times we rerun that whole conversation in our mind, or we run that whole episode in our mind, and then we realize that probably we just jumped the gun, we misunderstood that person. So it happens many times. So one thing could be that I am misunderstanding the conversation or the tone of the conversation and I'm getting hurt. And the other thing is that person is really saying something that is provocative, right? These are the two things that can happen. So when people say something which is provocative, when they're saying something which is irritating us, angering us, or making us feel low, there can again be three things I can think of. One is either their intention is good, right? Many times people who come to us, criticize us, find faults with us, do it with a very, very good intention. That is one set of people. Then there is the other set whose intention is to hurt. And sadly, even we do this sometimes. And of course, as a first step, we should try to avoid doing it to others. But people do it to us. You know, there are people who, in a conversation, they want to cut you short. They want to put you in your place. So there are people who are critical and judgmental purely for the sake of being provocative, right? Not with any good intention. There's a second set of people. But a lot of people are both of this together. They do have good intentions, but also they want to provoke you into seeing that what you're doing was wrong, right? So there are people who do both too. So first we will deal with the situation where we tend to misunderstand what is being told to us in a conversation. In fact, this is in a sense an extension of what we spoke last week. And if 1 week is too long a time for you to remember what we spoke about last week, we spoke about what Swami says, that what you see outside is a reflection of what is within. And in that, as part of that answer, I had said that many times we fill the scene that is in front of us with our perceptions. We don't see it completely, we fill it with our perceptions, and that causes a lot of problem, because we have created a scenario which is not completely true, and all the time we are responding and dealing with that scenario which is actually farther from truth. And that is something which similarly happens even in conversations too, right? Most of us are very, very bad listeners. And in fact, listening itself is a very, very spiritual art. And that is one thing which Swami always wanted us to learn. And I think in one of the discourses, Swami mentions that that's the reason why most of the masters, Swami included, and they would always speak in cryptic language. They would speak very softly. They would speak, they would not be very verbose. And the moment the speech of the master becomes very rare to get, you become more attentive. So Swami would say that it is a process by which we become better listeners when we are at least in the presence of the master. So to be able to listen completely is an art by itself, and I think most of us are in the process of learning it, and we must consciously make the effort to become better listeners. Sometime back I got this forward, and I'm sure most of you would have got this. It's actually a very common thing, especially when you learn English. They show you that there is this paragraph which is a regular, I think, a couple of sentences, but the problem with this paragraph is it's filled with spelling mistakes. Almost every word in that paragraph is misspelled, except the prepositions and the the articles and the others. So most of it is misspelt. But the beauty is you will be able to read that entire paragraph almost without stopping anywhere. And so they go on to say that this is how the mind works. The mind actually never reads an entire word. It reads the first alphabet and the last alphabet and probably a couple of vowels in between, and it already knows what that word is, and it starts, the moment you know the word, you kind of predict what is going to be the next word, and in that manner you are able to read an entire sentence even though it is filled with innumerable spelling mistakes. And the interesting thing is, that's what we do in conversations too. We hardly listen to a person entirely. We listen in parts, and the gaps in between, we fill it with our misunderstandings or our perceptions, right? And that is why to learn this art of reading is listening is very, very important. I'm sure regular listeners will know that. I'm also part of another program in the evening, which is called Shravanam Mananam Nididhyasanam, which means you listen, reflect, and absorb. And as part of that program, we have mentioned this many times. Apparently, Swami had said this to one of the devotees. He said, the sequence is very important. Shravanam, Mananam, and then Nididhyasanam. Swami said, Shravanam, listening, and then Mananam. Mananam is the process of thinking or reflecting within your own mind. So Swami said, it is very important to not think too much while listening, and then do that thinking part only after you've completed the listening. Right? And that is actually a very, very important thing that we don't do. And to start with, can we listen to people keenly? You know, do it as an exercise. You don't have to be in a situation where the person is criticizing you or judging you. Can we, you know, look at every conversation keenly, give all our mind to what that person is saying, and be absolutely non-judgmental in what he's speaking? Just listen to that person completely, right? And most of the time, especially within the family, within friends, within close associates, most of the problems arise because of miscommunication. And it's not completely miscommunicating to the other person, but making flaws in listening, right? The reason why this happens is, you know, it's because of the very nature of the mind. The mind is all the time overworking, right? It does more than what you and I would want it to do. It thinks more than what is necessary. It is all over the place, as we always say, right? And it just reminds me of one thing which Swami would tell us when we were students, you know, especially about food. Swami would say this. He would say, rest a while after lunch and walk a mile after dinner. Swami would very often say this when we were students. He said, if you do this, you'll be healthy. After you finish your lunch, rest a while. Not necessarily you have to sleep. Even if you can just lie down and take a bit of, give that food to digest. And then Swami would say, after dinner, walk a mile after dinner. And the important thing is, it is you finish your food and then you walk, right? If you finish your food and then you rest. The problem comes if we do both together. You can't keep walking and then eating. You can't lie down and then eat, right? So the same thing goes with listening and thinking too. We first have to listen, and then we have to think, and then we have to respond, right? But even worse, what we do, some of us don't listen completely, nor do we think, but we just speak out. And that is where most of the problem comes. So this miscommunication has to be avoided as much as possible. Practice this listening. And as I said, in normal conversations, you remind yourself when you're talking to a person that I should not think, I should listen. I should not think, I should listen. And another way which is very beautiful, it is spoken of even in other philosophies like the Zen philosophy and some other forms of meditation. There is something which is called listening meditation. I don't know if that is the terminology they use for that. It's called listening meditation, where they say you go and sit out in a park or you go sit in the garden and you try to listen to every sound that reaches you. Every sound. Be conscious of, you know, the sound the birds are making while they're chirping, the rustling of the leaves, probably a car which is driving by, children playing, or the sounds of the crows, whatever it is, you consciously try to listen to every small sound that you're able to hear. don't plug in earphones and listen to music. That's not how it is. You sit and listen to every sound that comes out in the environment. And they say that this is a means by which you're trying to concentrate on what is coming from outside. And in the process, you're silencing the noise inside. It's called listening meditation. And it really helps, because in a conversation, this is exactly what we have to do. We have to listen from outside and reduce the volume of that noise which goes on inside in our minds, right? And these two things, you know, these three things you can try. One is remind yourself to listen when you're in a conversation, and try listening meditation, and try to do this in a normal conversation. You know, not in a conversation which is exciting you, not in a conversation which is making you feel low or making you feel excited or angry or upset. In a normal conversation, in every normal conversation, try to keenly listen. Well, that's about misunderstandings when we listen. But what about occasions when people are really saying things which are hurting us, which is making us angry, and how do we deal with that now? In most of these cases, you know, whenever there is an excitement that happens within us when we are talking to somebody, there is a certain pattern in which the events happen, right? And what is that? First, there is a stimulus, right? Whatever that person is saying, whatever criticism that you're hearing, or that person is speaking very harsh words, that is the stimulus, right? The next is the rise of the emotion within you, either it is anger or depression or whatever it is, the emotion that follows the stimulus. And the third is the expression of the emotion. And this is very critical to note, that the emotion and the expression of the emotion are two different things. I could be a very quiet person. I might not shout out in anger. I might not cry visibly with tears. But if that emotion is within me, it's as bad as, probably not as bad, but it still hurts you within. You might not be hurting the environment outside, but you will be hurting within, and that's still a problem, right? So there is a stimulus. There is the rise of emotion within. And then there is that expression of that emotion. In the case of anger, you shout out, or you attack that person back, or whatever it is, there's an expression of the emotion that is built in. And after some time, after that emotion starts subsiding, that is when the thinking process starts. As you said, you look back at the conversation and you're thinking, you know, what went wrong? Did I read that person right? So invariably, this thinking process happens after, you know, the expression of the emotion phase is over. So now, generally when we say controlling the anger, what we generally do is, we are only talking about controlling the expression of anger. I'm taking the case of anger, because anger is one thing which is very, very explosive, right? It's more than... The depression is something which makes you go inward, you become an introvert, when anger is something which you explode with. And so that will make a good example. So in the case when we get very angry, most of the time we are only trying to control the expression of the anger. And Swami has also given many techniques for that. You know, when he says that when you're very angry in a situation, Swami says, leave that place, don't continue the conversation. Or Swami had told us once in Trivandrum, he said, when you get very angry, go and look at the mirror. And, you know, you have the ego of wanting to look good. And when you're angry, you're invariably looking so ugly that you wouldn't like to continue to be angry anymore, right? Or Swami would say, go drink some water. But then Swami would say, expend that energy, because when you're angry, you're so agitated and you're so excited. Swami would say, go and do some work. Go and take a jog. Go and, sweep your home or do whatever it is. You expend that anger. But the problem with this technique is, this is only one level of anger management, where you're only managing the expression of anger. And this is typically the situation probably you would see in the case of a pressure cooker, right? When you don't allow the cooker to express itself, you hold it back, and finally there is a loud whistle. Swami says the same thing happens. If you have not dealt with the source emotion, the expression alone is dealt with, so which means that source emotion can keep throwing out that emotion every now and then. And sometimes this could even be over many, many years and months, isn't it? We think that we have gotten over the anger. Then we see that person again, then again that anger seems to be coming from within. or we have not met the person who has done us some harm, and after many, many years, somebody mentions their name, and then suddenly you find this anger starts boiling within. It's just the case that you have dealt with the expression of anger, but you have not dealt with the anger itself. So what are we supposed to do? As I said, the first step is, of course, deal with the expression of anger. That's very important, because we mess up the situation much, much more when we speak in anger, when we speak when we are depressed, when we speak when we are feeling very, very low. We end up hurting the other person when we speak in such situations. So first thing is, of course, control the expression of anger. And when you do that, what you're essentially doing is, you are increasing this time gap between the emotion arising in you and the expression happening, right? You are increasing that time gap. It doesn't guarantee that the expression will not happen. Maybe it will happen after some time. So what we need to do is, as Swami had explained this to somebody, this thinking that happens after this emotion arises and expresses itself, and then you calm down and then you start thinking, Swami says, can you consciously bring that thinking part between the point where the emotion arises and then you try to express it? Bring that thinking part in between. And that is when you're actually dealing with the emotion itself and not merely the expression of that emotion. And that thinking varies with different situations. If somebody is saying something which is very hurting, the kind of thinking that you have to do is different. One thing I can think of is, you know, one of the first few Uncle Lion's tales that we published on our website. If you go, I think it's the first or second cartoon that we had put out. There is this very beautiful story of a shopkeeper who is having this, I think a sari shop or something, and he's known for his very calm and peaceful nature. So one day, a child walks into the shop, and he's a spoiled child, a brat, and you know, he just wants to have fun provoking this shopkeeper. So he takes one sari and he asks this man, you know, how much is this? And the shopkeeper says it's 200 rupees. So he tears it into two halves, and he asks him, how much is one half? So very, very calmly that man replies that, and it should be half of 200, so it's 100. So this boy again tears that half into a quarter and he says, how much is this quarter? And very calmly, without getting agitated, that man says, well, that should be 50 then. And this boy gets surprised. He said, aren't you getting angry with me? I'm trying to provoke you and you don't seem to be getting angry. And the answer which that person gives is very beautiful. He says, you know, the sari that you tore apart was only 200 rupees. But if I were to get angry with you, the peace of mind which I will lose is far more precious than the sari that you tore, right? Why I'm saying this is one of the ways in which we think. This is one of the ways in which we think after we cool down. So can we bring this thinking in between before we express that emotion and that emotion arising? And what will happen over a period of time is that we will realize that this becomes a spontaneous process. Someone is saying something which is hurting. Yes, we might get angry. Yes, immediately there's that emotion rising. But like a practice, you know, you will start immediately following it up with this thinking to calm yourself down. And with time, you'll realize that it happens almost simultaneously. And eventually, you will realize that that emotion itself does not arise. And this happens over a period of time. And this is, I'm not telling this as a technique. This was told as a technique 5,000 years ago, right? I'll come to that in a bit. So this is one way you deal with people telling something which is very hurtful. Now, talking about something which was also mentioned in the question, how do we react to criticism, right? That is something which always comes. And, you know, being the host of the show, being the person who is involved in many other radio shows and our programs and articles, I can tell you that we also face a fair amount of criticism. By Swami's grace, not much, but fair amount of criticism. And invariably, you know, what happens, I have noticed this, and this is an observation of myself, and I'm sure all of you will also be able to relate to it. When somebody comes and says something which is critical, invariably, the mind starts racing not to defend yourself. Yeah, defending yourself is fine, but I mean, that is also not completely fine, but that's all right. But even worse is the mind starts racing to find faults in the person who's criticizing us. To tell that person that, you know, you have all these faults, so you don't tell me what I'm supposed to do. And this is actually a very, very dangerous habit of the mind, right? So what we need to do, especially when someone is criticizing, is can we look at that criticism as objectively as possible and say that, is there any truth to that criticism which is coming my way? Somebody is saying something which is very judgmental. Yes, we don't like to be judged. Yes, we don't like to be criticized. But can we objectively look at those words and say that, is there any amount of truth in what is being told? Is there even 1% fact in the criticism which is coming my way? And if it is so, can I accept that? And if it is not so, then you say that, you know, I have nothing to do with this. I have nothing to do with these words. It is an expression of probably that person's restlessness within. It has got nothing to do with what I am. And that is why I often say this. I always find this as the best analogy I can think of. Even a tattered, old, dirty, dusty looking book, if it speaks about the value of cleanliness, and if we read it, we need to accept the value of cleanliness. We can't say the book is dirty, so I will not accept the value of cleanliness. And that's what we always do. If a person is giving us criticism, can we separate that person from the criticism and say, if there is value in the criticism, I accept it. If there is no value, then fine, we'll just let it go, right? So coming back to what I said, that these advices which are not new, it has come many, many years before. Its reason is, as I said, whether we misunderstand when someone is communicating to us, whether we overreact when somebody criticizes us, or maybe someone is telling us something just as a simple piece of advice, then we start thinking over it again and again and go into a low mode. All of this, why does it happen? It all happens because of the fickleness of the mind, right? It all starts with that. It's all because the mind is unbridled, right? So the whole problem of this is coming from the mind being fickle, and that is why I said that as we progress spiritually, we'll see automatically these problems being solved, even if we are not consciously trying to solve them. So the same thing happened, and you know, this is the very question that Arjuna puts to Krishna, right? In the, I think it's in the chapter 6 of the Bhagavad Gita, where he says that famous shloka on the mind. He says, Chanchalam hi manak Krishna pramadi balavad dridam vridam tasyaham nigraham manye vayur riva sudushkaram. Sorry, that's what he says. Restless indeed is the mind of Krishna. It is vehement, strong and unconquerable. I deem it as hard to control as the wind. Right? This is what Krishna says. He says the mind is running all over the place and I'm not able to control it. It's like the wind. It cannot be contained. And what is the beautiful advice that Krishna gives? When I read this, you will realize that that's what we've been discussing so far. Asamshayam mahabahu mano dur nigraham chalam abhyasena tu kaunteya vairagena cha grihyate. He says, the Blessed Lord says, without doubt, O mighty armed, the mind is restless and very difficult to restrain. But O Kaunteya, it may be controlled by constant practice and non-attachment. Right? Constant practice and non-attachment. Vairagya and Abhyasa. That is what Krishna says. As I said, this can only happen with practice. When you constantly practice listening, when you constantly practice not reacting, when you constantly practice saying that I will take the criticism which is applicable to me. And the other reason why we invariably react is because of our ego. You know, we say that that person is attacking me, or that person is attacking someone who is close to me or related to me. And unless we give up a little bit of that ego, this process will not go forward. And you will have to detach yourself from the person being criticized to be able to accept criticism and to accept judgment as objective. To sum up whatever I've been saying, first of all, much of what we face in relationships or conversations especially happens because we have not learned the art of listening. So learn the art of listening. And this also includes reading the emotion of the person who is speaking to you. And if that person is speaking in an excited point, I mean, if he or she is angry or he or she is very, very disturbed in saying this, your listening also includes reading that emotion of the person and saying that, all right, this person is not in her senses or she is not in her senses. So let me discount that. Let me not take what she is saying in anger seriously. Let me not take what he is saying when he is depressed too seriously. So first of all, learn the art of listening. The second, can we be open to criticism? Say that if there is any value in the criticism, I'll take it from wherever it comes. That person may be the worst person to give me that criticism. That does not matter. If that criticism is valid, can I take it? And as I said, the whole problem is because of the ego. The ego refuses to be hurt by anybody or anybody's words. So many times, just accepting our flaws and say that, yes, this was where I was wrong. I'm sorry about that. That has a lot of value in subduing this ego, and that will help us be more sportive when criticism comes. So if you, every time that you find that you have done a mistake and you have to own up that mistake, make bold and say, yes, I was wrong. This was the mistake I did. And that will definitely go a long way. Then the second thing which I said, we need to value our peace of mind, like that story which I said. We need to value our peace of mind more than what others think of us, you know, what will be the talk which happens behind me. We must say, that is why spirituality is always about going inward. There is the whole world outside which we have no control over, but we have this one being within which we have all the control over, and our focus and energy should be on this. And we must prioritize our peace of mind over anything else. And say that if this is going to spoil my peace of mind, it's not worth holding back in my mind and letting go. And the last point which I want to mention, which I didn't mention so far, is can we keep one yardstick to judge yourself? You know, that is something which is very important, because we cannot please the whole world. We cannot be taking everybody's criticism. We all know that Chinnakatha which Swami would say about, a man who is... buying a donkey. I don't know. It's a legendary story, you know, the man who's buying a donkey. First his son is riding the donkey, then he rides the donkey, and then both of them ride the donkey. And every time somebody criticizes them, no, how can you do this? So everybody will have problems with everything that we do. So can we keep one yardstick to judge our actions? That is, do what is right, do what is good. And if we are, of course, having Swami as a very important figure in our life, can we say that I want to please Swami, everything else does not matter. If somebody criticizes us, ask, is that criticism valid in me trying to please Swami? If it is not valid, it's not worth giving mind space to and letting go of that. So this was the answer. I thought, I hope I've at least covered a fair bit and have given enough to work on. So Sister Prashanthi, I would be very glad to listen from you how you, what you thought was useful in the answer. If you have any more clarifications on the question, or you want to ask any other question, of course you're always welcome to write to me at prem@radiosai.org. That, dear listeners, was the question. And the other thing which I wanted to do today was read for you a very, very beautiful poem. In fact, I'm not going to just read the poem for you. It's written by Swami in Telugu, so that explains why I cannot read it. I have a recitation of the poem in Telugu, and I also have the meaning of the verse one by one, and that's what I'm going to do. I'll play that Telugu for you, because it's so beautiful even to listen, even if you don't understand it. This poem features in Swami's Vahini, the Sandeha Nivarini, and it's a beautiful conversation. We all know Sandeha Nivarini has been written by Swami in the form of a conversation between Swami and a devotee, but completely written by Swami. And as I always tell whenever I speak about Sandeha Nivarini, if you read Sandeha Nivarini, you will realize what is the expectation that Swami has of us devotees, even when we ask a question or a doubt from Swami. Because that is the level which Swami wants us to be. And in the course of that Sandeha Nivarini, there is a point where Swami promises this devotee that he will explain to him the nature of the true self. And Swami tells him that before I explain that, I'm going to listen to this Burrakatha, which will tell you what you are not. And then Swami writes in the book, he says that if you attentively listen to this Buddhakatha, understanding its meaning and absorbing its meaning, Swami says it will give you vairagya. And once that vairagya comes, you will be able to understand the truth of yourself much, much more easily. And this is Swami himself saying that if you concentrate, contemplate and absorb this poem as it is, it can give you the, you know, highest vairagya, which will help you reach the truth. So this is a Buddhakatha with Swami's, you know, in typically the folk style in Telugu. And we'll listen to that, and I'll try to explain each of those verses as we listen to the Telugu version of it.
Taitai taitai bomma, dini tamasha jodara maya bomma. Khyatiga dini ki mundu venkagala, kadhavivarintunu vinujiva. Taitai taitai tai bomma, dini tamasha jodara maya bomma.
So that is the first paragraph of that Tai 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 Bomma. Swami is saying that I'm going to tell you the story of a doll, right? And this doll is a very, very funny doll. And the whole story I'm going to tell you is about this doll's past, future, what happens to it, what happens around it. And Swami says that it's a very hilarious story. So I'm going to relate the story of this Tai Bomma or a dummy doll.
మాతృ గర్భమున మలమూత్రముల రోతల నీవు రోదింప ప్రీతిగ వీరలు పేరంటమ్ములు చేతురిదెంతటి చిత్రమురా తైతై తైతై తై బొమ్మ దీని తమాష జోడర మాయబొమ్మ.
Swami says this doll was in the mother's womb and it was floating and swimming blissfully in its, as Professor Kasturi writes, the mushy mire. The way Professor Kasturi translates that paragraph is, it rolled at first in mushy mire of mother's womb, its prison dark. It came with a whimper, but all around they smiled in joy and fees galore. He says that when this child is born out of this prison, which is the mother's womb, this child is crying and creating such a ruckus, but everybody around seemed to be so happy. Isn't that the scene to which all of us were born? And Swami would often quote this example of how when we are born, we are all crying and everybody around is laughing.
Puttiti madi golpoyiti durgati pattitinani nee vedavaga atte navvuchun aanandinchada ritti veeru nee kevarayya taitai taitai tai bomma deeni tamasha jodara maya bomma.
Swami says here that when we cry, actually the cry, Swami defines the cry as the child saying that, oh God, what tragedy has befallen me, I am born again. You know, I'm again being born into this world, what a fate it is of mine. And Swami says that's how the child cries. That is the essence of that child crying and being born. But not recognizing this emotion of the child, everybody around is laughing and nobody is able to empathize with this emotion of that child.
Masilo mattina malamutramulan masaluchu sigganu maatayeleka pasipapadavai padachu lechuchu dinamoka nataka maadavoko taitai taitai tai bomma deeni tamasha chodara mayabomma.
You know, the whole idea of this thing is Swami saying that here is the jivatma which has much, much more wisdom than it seems to be having. And that's what Swami says, that even in that cry, Swami is telling it is not a cry of ignorance, but it's a cry of knowledge, that I am born into this world which is full of pain and sorrow and ups and downs. But, you know, Swami says that after some time it seems to have forgotten this. And it says that now it is like wallowing in its dirt and it has no sense of shame. It is rolling and every time it's trying to walk, it is falling down. And every day it is, you know, so immersed in a childish play. And how gradually this knowledge, which was there at the time when the child was in the womb and also seemed to be there when the child was born, seemed to be drifting away from it. And this dummy doll now seems to be something which is giving joy to everybody around through its pranks and little plays.
తోడి వారలతో కూడియాడుచు వేడుగతో పలు విద్యలు నేర్పుచు చూడ చూడగా చోద్యపు కళతో ఏడేడునకు ఎదిగే బొమ్మ తైతై తైతై తై బొమ్మ దీని తమాష జోడర మాయబొమ్మ.
And even as people are watching it, it runs around, makes friends, and this all-knowing jivatma now is going through life and learning new tricks and reveling in all the tricks that it learns. Swami is talking about the boyhood phase, or, you know, in the phase when, in the girlhood phase, if I could also say that, you know, when we are spending time with our friends, when we are learning new tricks, we are learning to ride a bicycle, when you are learning to play an instrument, all of that. Swami is saying that, you know, in the beginning of that poem, Swami says this is all the drama of ignorance, right? Here is this all-knowing Jivatma, which seems to have forgotten everything, and now reveling at every small talent and thing that it is learning. Every small thing it is learning, it is rejoicing it. And even as people are watching it, from year to year, it grows fast and it grows fatter and more sturdier. And this doll is now growing from the stage of being a child and being a young adult to being an adult.
Patiyani satiyani sarasabhavamuna jatajeruchu samsara rangamuna ati kautukamuna nantakanna nika anyamuledani aditire taitai taitai taibamma dini tamasha jodara mayabamma.
This is Swami is talking about when this doll has grown big enough to call somebody as my husband, my wife. And now it starts finding joy in that companionship of a husband or wife. And not only does it find joy in the companionship of another individual, but Swami says that in this phase, that this doll thinks that there cannot be any joy greater than this. All the joy that I need in life can be found in this companionship of this another doll. That's what Swami says. That one doll meets another doll and it's reveling in the samsara, and all the colors of samsara is thrilling it, and it is enjoying this phase thinking that there cannot be a joy greater than this. There cannot be sweetness greater than what I'm experiencing in this phase.
బొమ్మను బొమ్మను పొందుపరచి పలు బొమ్మలు సేయుర బ్రహ్మయ్య నమ్ముటవన్నీయు నావేయని ధిమ్ధిమ్మని వానితో నాడుదుగా తైతై తైతై తై బొమ్మ దీని తమాష జోడర మాయుబొమ్మ.
Swami adds very beautifully, you know, it is the divinity which makes one doll go and find companionship with the other doll, and in the process many millions and millions of such dolls are created. Right, Swami is talking about procreation. And Swami says that this is the play of Brahman. This is the play of the divine creator. Right? But what does this doll think? The doll looks at this other small doll which is created because of its companionship with a wife or a husband and says, oh, this is my doll. This is my dummy doll. And Swami says, you know, what a foolish and what a hilarious thing this is. That this is the work of God. And two dolls come together and more dolls are created. And these two dolls grab those little dolls and say, these are my dolls. These I have created.
Dhanamu gurchuneda dachi pettuneda dani benchanadi chaninapudun tanugu todani manasu todani tandavamennaga taramouna taitai taitai taibamma dini tamasha chodara mayabamma.
And this is about the phase where, you know, most of us, what we would probably call the midlife, right? We've had a family, we're having children, and the time where we are economically more productive, where we are trying to earn more, we are trying to save more. Swami is saying that all your life you are earning, saving, trying to make that wealth that you've gathered grow and make it safe, and put it in insurance and put it in fixed deposits. Swami is saying all the while you completely forget that, you know, you can revel with it as much as you want, but when the time comes to let it go, you can't take even a penny with you. And this knowledge is completely forgotten in this phase. That's what Swami is saying. In this phase of life, you're only thinking about earning and hoarding money, forgetting that not even one bit of what you save and earn can be taken along with you.
Kamamu krodhamu gattikolaga tamasambumuku daduluagan kaminiyun kanakambu chetilo gangireddulai gantulu vesi taitai taitai taibamma dini tamasha chodara mayabamma.
This is a very interesting imagery which Swami is creating here. You know, Swami used to talk about this especially during Sankrantis, where you would have these bulls decorated and they would be brought in procession into the village. And these bulls, Swami would say that, you know, if you've noticed it in southern India, they have a rope which is put through the nose, and that is how the bull is controlled, because otherwise the bull is very violent. Right? By tugging at this rope, the bull is controlled. And Swami says that lust and anger, kama and krodha are like these strings, right, which are put through this the nostril of this bull. And Swami would also say that they would perform the marriage of the bull during the Sankranti festival. So they will ask that bull, would you like to marry this cow? And the person who is the caretaker of the bull, he would have something like a whip. And he will not beat the bull, he will shake the whip. And along with the shaking of the whip, the bull will shake its head too. And they will say that the bull has given the consent, so let's perform the marriage. Right? So Swami is referring to that by saying that wealth and desire for women or the desire for sensual pleasures, these are like those whips that man is shaking. And just like how that bull shakes its head when that whip is shown, whenever wealth comes in front of you, whenever pleasure in the form of sensual pleasures comes in front of you, you readily shake your head and you accept it. And you don't realize that you're actually becoming a slave to this. You think that you are getting it, you are having control over it, you are earning it. Swami says you're forgetting that actually what is happening is you are, in the real sense, becoming a slave to that, like this bull which is tied up in the nostril by these twines of kama and krodha and is ready to at any time fall prey for these two things of, you know, more wealth and sensual pleasures. Well, dear listeners, actually that's not the end of the poem. In fact, it's a poem which runs into 24 such paragraphs and each one, 27 such paragraphs, and each one is so very profound. So probably over the next couple of weeks, we'll go into all of these, the meanings of these various paragraphs. Once again, if you want to read it, it's in the Sandeha Nivarani, I think chapter 5, where Swami narrates this whole thing. Professor Kasturi has done a very beautiful translation of it. Of course, he's tried to keep the poetic flavor. And probably in the process, some of the words have not been very precisely translated. But as you can hear, the poem itself is so very beautiful and so very profound. So over the next few weeks, we'll go into the meaning of that. But we'll end with that because the time's up and it's time for the next show to come up. And I'll have to go to come back again at 12:30 for the afternoon satsang. But this time I'm not doing it with Arvind. I'm going to do it with somebody else. But I'll let you know when you come back at 12:30. I want to end the program with a very, very beautiful Hindi song. It's one of my favorites as always. That's why I play these songs for you. And I thank Sister Prashanti for her question. I thank all of you for your very, very patient listening. And I most humbly offer this effort at Swami's lotus feet. Do join me again next week at 11 a.m. for the next episode of Radio Sai Answering Booth.
तेरा है फूलों जैसा बातें जैसे गीत सुधा तेरी मुस्कानों में लगता मधुर कोई संगीत सजा उपकारों की मूरत हो हर सांसों की जरूरत हो तुम मीत मेरे नवनीत सखा साईं मां साईं Oh, के दिन है कितना सुहाना, जागी उमंगे गाए तराना, पंछी बादल ठंडी हवा, कदमों पे तेरे पलके बिछाए, भगवान अरमान हो तुम, पहचान हो तुम, जान हो तुम, प्यार तेरा है फूलों जैसा, बातें जैसे गीत सुधा, तेरी मुस्कानों में लगता मधुर कोई संगीत सजा, उपकारों की मूरत हो तुम, हर सांसों की जरूरत हो तुम, मीत मेरे नवनीत सखा।